we have these neural circuitry that are designed for something, and now we try to co-opt them for very different problems, problems that they were not designed to do. So, you know, being afraid of a tiger is not the same of being afraid of about the stock of Tesla going down or going up. These are not the same thing, and they don't require the same mechanism, but the way that, that our psychology work is the same. But it's also the issue that we shouldn't feel helpless against that, but we should think about what do we do to improve things.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. When it comes to money, because it's so quantifiable, you'd expect people to make very rational decisions, but they don't. Because we're humans, we're more driven by our evolutionary wiring and our emotions. We make predictably irrational decisions, as today's guest expert would say. Dan Ariely is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics at Duke University and a founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. I've been looking forward for a long time to having him on this program to help us understand how the flawed decision-making we make impacts the markets, the economy, and our financial destinies. Dan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Lovely, lovely to be here. And in your lovely introduction of me, you did not mention that I also make the same decisions everybody else does. So it's really a part of our human nature, and overriding them is not easy.
Okay. Almost an inescapable part, I think you'd say.
It's tough, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, Dan, look, thanks so much for coming on the program. I'm really excited for this conversation. You and I've interviewed you before, but it was a long time ago. This is your first appearance on Wealthion. I hope the first of many. You have a new book coming out. We'll talk about that in a little bit to get folks prepped for when that's going to come out. I'm just letting folks know in advance, you're one of my favorite people to interview. This is going to be a really fascinating, interesting, and fun discussion. I'm a huge fan of yours, Dan, but I'm not sure all my viewers necessarily know who you are or even know what behavioral economics is. So could we just start with a quick summary of what is behavioral economics? And then once you've sort of explained that, how you came specifically to study it, because you've had a really interesting journey.
Sure. So are we on audio or also video in this podcast?
We're on video. People are seeing your beautiful face.
Okay, So maybe I'll start by saying something about half beards, and that will be both an introduction to behavioral economics and a little bit about my history, and then we'll give a definition. So obviously I have half a beard, and the question is why this strange look? And it has a couple of answers. And the first one is I was badly burnt. You know, most of my body is covered with scars, including the right side of my face, so this side just doesn't grow any hair. But of course, I could shave this side, and then it would look less stark. And indeed, for many years, I shaved. And then a few years ago, I went on a month-long hike. I didn't shave for that month. And then when I came out, I looked sort of like this, slightly less white, but sort of like this. And when I looked at myself in the mirror for the first time, I didn't like this look. I didn't like it, but I thought, you know, I earned it with a month-long hike. I'll keep it for a few weeks. And then two surprising things happened. And the first one was that I got some notes from people who thanked me for the half a beard. Now, why did anybody thank me for this half a beard? These were people who were struggling with their own injuries. They felt they were trying to hide it, and they felt I was doing it on purpose. And they said that me not caring gave them a little bit of strength to hide a little bit less. I didn't correct them. They'll say that this was by mistake, but I thought, you know, if this helps some people, maybe I should consider keeping it. So I said, I'll keep it for a little longer. And then the really surprising thing happened 4 months later, about 4 months later. And what happened was that all of a sudden, I realized that I felt differently about my injury and my scars. My whole body is deformed in all kinds of ways. And all of a sudden, I felt better about it. And I started thinking, what happened? Now, think about someone. somebody who goes and shave, they go in the morning with stubble and then they have less stubble. Somebody that, like me that shaved, I used to have stubble on one side, and after shaving, I would feel less non-symmetrical. I would lose less non-symmetrical. So the shaving was not just an act of shaving, it was also an act of reducing asymmetry. And stopping that actually had very healing effect. Think about what happened to somebody who every day tries to hide their injury. What are the effects that happens on the psychology of the person? And stopping that was incredibly helpful. Now, why is this a good introduction to behavioral economics? Because I think that a lot of times our intuitions about what motivates us are wrong. Think about me. I'm a social scientist. My mother thinks a relatively good one. Nevertheless, I did not predict that stopping shaving would have a beneficial effect. If you ask me about it, I could say, oh, yeah, you know, day one with half a beard would be unpleasant. I could predict that. Kids would point, people would laugh, people would ask questions. But if you ask me what are the long-term effects of that, there's nothing in my psychology that can have an intuition about that. And, you know, I did for many years, I shaved when I shouldn't have. I wish I stopped that, you know, earlier. And that for me is what behavioral economics is about. It's about trying to understand what intuitions we have about life that are correct, what intuitions are incorrect, and how do we fix things? How do we make things better?
All right, great introduction. And, you know, what I take away from the study of behavioral economics, and feel free to correct this in any way, is that, you know, we think, as I said in the intro, we think we would make excessively rational discussions around decisions around money because it's just so quantifiable. We could just do the math and find the right answer, right? But we end up making really bad or irrational decisions, and it's because we're human, right? And so we have this wiring, this evolutionary wiring that prepared us very well for certain types of environments. We don't really live in those environments anymore in the modern era. Right, we don't have to worry so much about the snarling tiger that's about to eat us, right? And those aren't the risks that we deal with on a day-to-day basis going forward. And so the world of finance, the world of money, it is a construct that we built on top of just our daily subsistence existence. Yeah. And you know, we have these limitations of the reality we've created ourselves that aren't necessarily optimized for the base neural wiring that we have. And so it's all about sort of trying to find our way in this world we've created for ourselves using a roadmap, if you will, a neural roadmap that maybe is pretty antiquated. Is that an accurate way to think about it?
I think that's a very fair way to think about it. That we have these neural circuitry that are designed for something, and now we try to co-opt them for very different problems. Problems that they were not designed to do. So, you know, being afraid of a tiger is not the same of being afraid of about the stock of Tesla going down or going up. These are not the same thing, and they don't require the same mechanism, but the way that our psychology work is the same. But it's also the issue that we shouldn't feel helpless against that. But we should think about what do we do to improve things. So there's a study that I think we talked about many years ago, but let me talk about it again, because for me it was, you know, like the things, some studies, I keep on learning from them after I finish them because I get to think about what it means more and more, and that's one of them. And here's a study. We try to get people in Kibera, which is a slum in Kenya, to save a little bit of money for a rainy day. And look, there's lots of temptation. Even in a place like Kibera, you can buy fruit and water and kerosene and a piece of candy. There's things to do. And people don't save money for a rainy day. And then, of course, when there's a rainy day, they have they need money, they borrow at a high interest rate, and things deteriorate from there. So there's lots of details for that, but one of the important things is that we gave them motivation to save. Some people, we said, try to save this week 100 shillings, about a dollar. Some people got a text message from their kids saying, it wasn't really from their kids. It came as if it came from their kids. Mm-hmm. Try and save 100 shillings. Some people got 10% match, 20% match. We gave them pre-match, matching with loss aversion, all kinds of things. But we had one condition when we gave them a coin about this size with 24 numbers written on the edge of the coin. We said, put this coin somewhere in your hat and every week scratch the number for that week. Scratch it with a knife like a minus if you didn't save, up and down if you save. And you know, from my description, you can probably guess that that condition created the highest level of saving. That condition created a higher level of saving than a 20% match. What was it about that condition? And the story behind this idea for a coin, you know, sometimes you say, like, where did this coin come from? This coin, this idea for the coin, came when I was in Soweto. Soweto is a very large, very complex city in South Africa with a very big slum. And I was there in a place that sells funeral insurance. And one of the things I saw was a father who bought funeral insurance. And in South Africa, funerals are very expensive. So people need insurance because they never have enough money to pay for it. So he bought funeral insurance. And he took the paper certificate and he gave it to his son. And as he was doing it, I was thinking to myself, what is this father doing? Why this ceremony? And I realized that in general, we can think about economic activities as visible and non-visible. Mm-hmm. Visible things are buying fruits or water or kerosene or a toy. Invisible, saving for retirement, saving, paying debt, buying insurance. And usually there's kind of an imbalance, right? You think about our neighbors. We know how much they're spending. We don't know how much they're saving. Think about how much would your family say thank you if you saved more? No, they wouldn't. If you spend on them, they would. And what this father did with his certificate was to tell his son, look, there'll be less food on the table, but I'm caring about you in another way.
So he made the non-visible more visible.
Exactly, exactly. And the coin was the same thing. People don't visit each other's huts in Kibera. These are not pleasant places. But it was a communication between the parents and the kids and the parents with themselves. There's another economic activity. And that made me think, you know, how do we get motivation? You know, there's all kinds of things like eating healthy, exercise, saving, paying debts, buying insurance, that our usual approach is to say, these are just miserable things, but go ahead and do them forever. It will be painful, it will be suffering, but just go ahead and do it. That's just not a good message. That's just not a good message. And I think one of the things we need to do is we need to think about how do we get those things to be slightly more enjoyable. Now, I don't think that saving could ever be as much fun as sitting on a beach drinking mojito, but Can we do something on making the invisible visible? Can we get people to feel proud that they're doing something? Can we get people to feel that they're doing what they intend to do? You know, there's lots of ways to find motivation. And what we need to do individually, by the way, is to find for ourselves the motivation to do the right things, right? All of us who struggle with eating healthy and exercise and so on, we know we need to do it. But I also think that financial institutions have to help us, right? It's not that we should be on our own. I think that the financial industry should figure out a way to get people to feel accomplished and proud and successful and that we're doing the right thing we're supposed to do because without that, it will be very hard to make the right decision. So going back to your issue is to say, okay, we have this ancient mechanism that doesn't fit the modern day. And some things we just have to work hard to say, okay, it doesn't fit. Let us, you know, we were not designed to think 40 years in advance, but we have to. But again, we're not helpless. Because one of the things we could do is we can re-engineer our environment. And to the extent that we can re-engineer our environment, we can get more mechanisms to help support the things that we want to. For example, if we can get, in the example in Kenya, the moment you get parents to be proud of the financial sacrifices that they're doing, it becomes less difficult.
So that's fantastic. And that's exactly kind of where I'm hoping to take this conversation, is how can we re-engineer our environment to help us make better decisions for our long-term benefit? Real quick, before we move into that territory fully, I remember from previous conversations with you, I just want to clarify a little bit some of how our current wiring is working against us, because you've touched on some of it already, where the type of problems that we are wired to face are the immediate ones. So from a time value, right? It's happening right now. That tiger is going to pounce now or he's not, right? So things that have, you know, it's not going to manifest for days, weeks, or years, like inflation or am I saving for retirement, right? We're bad at like really zeroing in on those and prioritizing those. The visible versus non-visible. I remember you saying, you know, again, going back to the crouching tiger, yeah, we can see the tiger, he's right there, he's going to get us or not. If it's something like global warming or the purchasing power devaluation of the currency, things that happen much more slowly, we don't see it happening in real time on a minute by minute basis. Again, we discount that really highly. Yep. I think there was one other one that really stuck in my mind. It was the fact that that there's some uncertainty in it, right? That like, oh, if we print all this money, we'll probably ruin the value of our currency. But you know what? Somebody smart might come along in between now and then and come up with a solution. So I don't need to worry about it so much today versus, again, the tiger, he's going to jump right now or not, right? Yeah. So what are the type of solutions that we are wired well for to deal with? And where do we really trip ourselves up? Are they the areas I just mentioned, or are there more?
So there are more. There are more. So one of the big categories of things we do wrong, which is part of the now versus later, is of course emotions, right? Nobody should make long-term decisions in the stock market based on emotions. Mm-hmm. But of course, emotions get evoked outside of us, right? It's not that you say, oh, let me be happy or let me be sad. Something happened in the outside world and that activates us, right? So you go, you open your portfolio, you discover that one of your investment lost a lot, you know, and you can't help but ask yourself, why did I do this? Or I feel terrible, I'm really sad, and so on. Like, now you're overwhelmed by emotion. And, you know, are you in a good position to make a good decision? No.
It's sorry to interrupt, but social media, I'm sure, has just made this way worse. And let's go back to the crypto boom, right? You go on the line and you see all these people showing their Lamborghinis that, oh my God, I just made $5,000 into 5 million. I bought this crypto coin, right? Yeah.
So I think one category to think about is emotion, long-term, short-term. And another category is that our difficulty of changing our past decisions, this is sometimes called the sunk cost. Mm-hmm. So you bought a stock at 100, it's now down to 80. You're not thinking of it as something that you bought at 80. You think about it as something that you bought at 100 and it's now down at 80. Now, the fact that it went down doesn't matter. You have to ask, is it going to go up and down looking forward? But we can't get over our past decisions. And anyway, there's lots of other ones, but I'll give you one other that I find very interesting, which is what we call value cues. So when we come to evaluate something, what are the things that get us to value it as positive? So think about something like wine. We know that if you give people the same wine and you tell half of them it's from California and half of them it's from North Dakota, they think the one from California is higher. But I'll give you one other version of it, because it also connects to the world of finance. And this is about effort. It's about effort. So imagine the following experiment. Condition one, you search for a flight. You type the search query and you press enter and boom, you get the result immediately. People are happy. Condition two, you type the search query, you press enter, and you wait 12 seconds. You get the black screen and the wheel of death. Mm-hmm. And you wait for 12 seconds. People hate it. Happy to get the results immediately. Hate getting, waiting 12 seconds. Condition three is inspired by Kayak, the search engine for flights. You type the query, you press enter, and you wait. It's the same 12 seconds. But those 12 seconds are filled with, we're searching United, we're searching American, things are moving on your screen up and down. What happens now? It turns out that people are happier than if they didn't wait at all. Now, it doesn't mean that if you ask people and say, hey, do you want to wait? People say yes. That's not the case. But what happened is that at the end of this story with Kayak, people say, wow, my goodness, I understand what Kayak is doing for me. This is sometimes called operational transparency. You're saying you're doing lots of magical things for people. Why don't you at least tell them? And the big thing about it is that we don't just estimate the value of what we get. What is the quality of the search query? We also estimate the effort that went into it. You know, think about financial advisors. When we talk to financial advisors, we don't really know how much work they put into anything, right? The reality is that to make a decision about something not to invest in can take as much time as what to invest in. Mm-hmm. But we don't see that. But in a world in which we have a hard time evaluating things directly, and we evaluate them based on value cues, one of those value cues is effort. How much effort has gone into it? And because of this, is something as more effort has gone into it, we're willing to pay more for it. So the specific point I want to make is that effort is really important. But the more general point is to understand that when we come to evaluate things, evaluating things directly is sort of difficult. So we evaluate indirectly. In the same way that we evaluate, you know, I don't know, a plane, we can't go out and check the engines. So we look at the plane relative to how clean the bathrooms are. Mm-hmm. You know, the bathrooms don't necessarily tell you how good they're taking care of the plane, but we kind of make this inference. And sometimes value cues are good, but sometimes they're not so good. So we don't get to evaluate things in the same way for them. If the value cues are just not good value cues or we don't have them, we might underestimate something dramatically.
Right, right. And so you want to be very choosy in which value cues you pay attention to, and also make sure that someone's not showing you a really clean bathroom to make you think that they've got a great airplane when they're saying, I can fool people with a clean bathroom and really underinvest in my airplane. All right, fascinating. All right, so again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but so we have this sort of imbalance of neural wiring that we evolved given the more abstract worlds that we live in now. And I would say that the wiring we have is, you know, it's fairly primal, right? It's maximize my advantage in the immediate term now, right? I come across the fruit tree, let me eat them all because I have no idea when I'm going to have calories next, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Which kind of force us to prefer like kick the can type of solutions. Let me push off any pain to tomorrow and let me maximize.
I'm not sure. I don't think I like the term force us, but
okay.
But let's say it makes it more likely or more natural. Our natural reactions are a bit too much like that. And part of the story about designing our environment is that it's in our best interest to redesign the environment to perform better. So, you know, changing people is very tough. Changing ourselves is very tough. But changing our environment is the right mechanism to get us to be better. So I'll give you a trivial example. So this desk is a standing desk. If I come in the morning and it's in the sitting position, I sit. If I come in the morning and it's in the up position, I stand. Now I could, it's electronic. It's a button. It's not a big deal. But if I set it up in the evening, it's much, much better. If I set it in the morning, by the time I come in, I just want to get into things. Like it's only a few seconds, but it matters. So, you know, sadly, there's no clock connected to this. But if there was a way to make it go up every night, I would stand more. If there's a way to make the invisible visible, if there's a way to schedule things online, in your calendar, and you say, I'm not going to check my portfolio more than, you know, whatever we want, frequency we want to do it, or here's my decision criteria, and I'm not going to deviate from that. So it is about designing our environment for a better outcome.
So I love that. And kind of where I was going with all of our shortcomings is they apply both on an individual level, but they also apply on a social level, right? So the organizations that are making decisions for us, they still have these same challenges, right? The folks running the Fed are politicians, right? They're subject to all these same idiosyncrasies. And I do want to talk policy in a little bit, but I think we have we've got more control over our own lives, right? So if the natural path for us is to maximize consumption now and push the payment for that, the repercussions for that off into the future, you know, that's probably why it's more likely that our politicians will choose inflation over deflation, right? Deflation, austerity hurts today. No politician wants to try to run an austerity platform. They'll always run on an inflationary one, right? So as
by the way, if you think about it this way and you ask, who has an easier time to delay gratification? Politicians or individuals? The answer is it's tougher for politicians. Right, because they have they're usually short-term politicians, right? We are going to be us in 20 years. Mm-hmm. The politicians are not going to be here in 20 years. So, it's not recommended, it's not correct, but if you think about the political system, and actually lots of other things, they were not designed with this understanding of short-term versus long-term benefits, but the political system is such that very few politicians will be willing to take short-term losses for long-term gains because they're not going to be here with us.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, I'd love to get some of your thoughts on if there are any policy reforms that you think could help out there, but let's stick with the individual first, just because that's what we can control. What are some of the behaviors that would be at the top of your list that we should adopt in order to re-engineer our environments and try to provide the breadcrumbs to encourage more of the behaviors that we want? What positive incentives can we bake into our lives from a behavioral standpoint that will improve our odds for benefiting more tomorrow?
Yeah. So, you know, one really interesting mechanism is what's called Ulysses contracts. And the mechanism comes from the story of Ulysses and the Sirens, where Ulysses knew that if the Sirens will come, he will divert the boat and crash it and everybody will die. So what did he do? He asked the sailors to tie him to the mast. This way he could hear the call of the Sirens, but he was tied up, so he couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And he asked the sailors to put wax in their ears. And this way they couldn't do anything. They didn't even know that the temptation, or well, they could do, but they didn't even know the temptation existed. They were just oblivious to the temptation. And these are two important mechanisms. Think about texting while driving. Ulysses himself, it's like he puts his phone in the trunk, yeah. Right? He could hear it calling, but he couldn't do anything. And for the sailors, they turned the phone off, right? They were unaware that it was ringing. And I think these are two important mechanism. If we understand how temptation gets the best out of us, then we think about it differently. Now, most people understand it at least in some areas. So for example, most people say, you know what, if I buy chocolate cake and I'll have it at home, I could say to myself that I'll eat a small piece every other day, but I probably wouldn't. So let me give up the cake completely. We understand the role of temptation, but we don't fully understand it. We don't fully understand, you know, the temptation to stay on social media, the temptation to make financial decisions, and so on. So I think one thing we need to do is we need to do a better analysis of the cases where temptation gets the best of us, and to think about how we remove temptation. Another thing that we need to think about is how do we adopt long-term good action plans, right? How we think long-term. So think about somebody who's a smoker. If you're a smoker and you enjoy smoking, and you think about life as one cigarette at a time, you would never stop smoking. You would say, is the next cigarette going to give me pleasure? Yes. Smoker, it does. Yeah. Is the next cigarette
going to kill me? Probably not. Right.
Yeah. No. So let's smoke another one. And then you say, and then another one, then another one. So the short-term way of thinking is destructive. It just doesn't let us get there. What we need to do is we need to think about what we want to do long-term. And then we need to create mechanism that get that program for us. And the benefit of the financial world is that it's much easier to do. So if I want to say, okay, here's my long-term strategy. I want to invest this amount of money every month, and I want to divide it with this kind of strategy, I can basically do it automatically, right? We can't do the same thing for food, right? Just imagine you could do the same thing for food, and you would say, oh, I want to eat every day. I want to eat a little bit of vegetables, and I want to eat some fruit, and I want this to be, and so on. Let it happen automatically for me. No, you can't.
Right.
The moment something becomes electronic, this is like a playground for social science and behavioral economics, because we say, okay, now we can do lots of things. If I want to get you to eat better, I would have to control restaurants and supermarket and your home and so on.
Right.
If I want you to come up with a long-term financial strategy and then implement it, much, much easier. So I'm not saying it's easy, but we have a lot of improvement in that because it's electronic, because we can do things in an automated way. We have lots of tools to help us think long-term and then just set it to go automatically for us. And that's what I think we should do more and more. We should say, when we come to make decision every time, we have more flexibility, but that flexibility comes with a cost. Here's an example. 401k. Imagine I say, why determine 401k contribution when you just join a company? Let's do it every month. Let's ask people to sit at the end of each month, see how much cost they have, how much bills they have, and so on. And every at the end of each month, write a check for your 401k. Mm-hmm. We can predict what will happen, right? It's probably not going to be that much.
Right. If your first tough month, you'll say, I gotta get out of this thing. Yeah.
That's right. So I think there's a huge place for thinking once in a while, once a year, designing long-term strategy and have those implemented. I also think there's other things, right? Invisible, making the invisible visible and getting our identity to be involved so we feel good about it. There are other things that we should be doing. But I think those are the starting point, is to say this is an area that we can do much better by automated.
Okay, approaches. Great. So what I take from at least the examples we've talked about so far, there's sort of removing the temptation to self-sabotage, right?
Exactly.
So there's that. Then there's just removing the friction from the system, which automation does. right? It removes the effort, right? And we're committed. All right, I made that decision. I just know I'm supposed to do it, right? And then the third, and I'm just wondering if you have any other examples of this making the invisible visible, because I think that's so super important, and it's relatively novel idea to me. But you know, the first two things we talked about are almost sort of removing the stick, right? But you want to have some carrot there, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, as we talk about, people aren't great with things that are very long term. It's so easy to get knocked off of those for, you know, whatever reasons, especially around money. You have a tight month, you know, you get laid off, whatever. Mm-hmm. We talked about, you can come up with a million and one reasons to not have to sacrifice today for something that's years and years down the road. So how do you make that a visible part of people's lives to the point where they take pride in it, and they don't want to give it up. They don't want to lose that part of their identity. And this is interview you, so I want you to talk. But one thing where I've witnessed this worked well is, for many years I did CrossFit. And CrossFit is, I think, very successful because, one, it has a really supportive community, which I don't think people really realized how much the role of mm-hmm. of people both encouraging you and holding you accountable had to the equation. But also, you were always writing you were tracking your PRs every day. You'd come in and you were writing your results on the board. You were making your fitness very visible to yourself and others. And once you had made progress, you didn't want to backtrack on that.
Yeah. So I agree with all of this. So first of all, it's true. We call this accountability buddies. And when you have people that you're accountable for, things are much, much better. Even if they don't really watch you, after a while you internalize the fact that people are watching you. Mm-hmm. So that's important. And with money, we have this really amazing thing where we don't talk about money. There was a reporter who wrote, I'm not sure if it's true or not, but he said that American men are more likely to talk about Viagra use than credit card debt.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah, I believe it too, but I'm just not sure if it's, I haven't seen the real numbers.
But your point being is, it's very taboo for us to talk about finances.
Very taboo. In social setting. Very taboo. You know, we don't talk about, like, what do you have for insurance, and did you find a better deal, and how do you figure out, like, give me advice. Like, I'm a little behind, and my kids are expecting this summer vacation. What do I do? How do I communicate this? So, you know,
and Dan, why is that? Because that's so self-destructive. Like, there's no cost except just asking the question. And these are the questions that really matter, yet we shy away from them.
Yeah. You know, I think, so you mentioned in the beginning that you thought that people, like, you would think that people are doing well with money because it's so precise. There's a decimal. But because it's so precise, it also has the opportunity to create a social hierarchy. So, you know, I think that's why we don't ask people about how much money they make. You know, like, you know, if somebody is more handsome than you or more funny or so on, there's still ambiguity around it, right? But if somebody makes, you know, $1,000 more per you a month, that just kind of create a hierarchy. And it's bad for the person who's behind, and it's bad for the person who's ahead. And there's all of a sudden something between us that you know, are you more successful? By how much? Do you think about yourself as being more successful? How does it work? And because it's so precise, it's very hard not to think about it, or not to focus about it, or not to do that. So I think this idea that one of us is dealing better with money than the other one, there's a risk that it will violate social norms of we're all together. It would create a hierarchy very quickly.
Right. Somebody's
successful.
We're suddenly not the same anymore. Yeah. Okay. I get that.
By the way, also. It's also very bizarre that very few people tell you how happy they are in life. Like, you know, how many people have you met and you say, how is life? And they say, oh, I couldn't believe it. My love life is just unbelievable. I'm just so happy. People are very easy to complain, right? But to say, I'm really happy, I don't think anybody has been ever as happy as I am. Let's just create a gap that is, you're taking yourself out of the picture. But because we don't communicate, there is a problem of information asymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Akerlof talked about the lemons problem in used cars. Say, why is it that when you take a used car, a car, and you drive it off the lot, in an hour it loses too much value, so much value? What happened in this hour? And he says, what happened is that there's a symmetry of information. The moment somebody drove that car for an hour, they know something that we don't. And because of that, but there's a symmetry of information. And every time there's a symmetry of information, there's a reduced value and so on. I think that in our financial lives, we don't ask for advice. We're embarrassed to talk about it. And because of that, the asymmetry of information is very high. And also it's easier to take advantage of us. If we find an amazing insurance, we don't go and tell people. Or if we, you know, we just don't do it. We just don't do it as much. I mean, some social networks sometimes for investment and so on, but certainly not enough. But again, we need to figure out ways around it, because it's not, while it's understandable, it's not giving us the advantages we need.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Sorry to interrupt, but just so you can build on this, you know, we're talking about making the visible visible. And it's like, if you don't talk about it, if you don't put it out there, you're not making it visible. So you can't take advantage of that benefit if you're...
That's right.
Yeah, so we've got to find a way to A, make it visible, but B, for us to care less that it's visible. In fact, more in a positive way than it is. Yeah,
exactly. So think about 401k. You have people that join a new job, and they have lots of forms to fill. And within that, there's one form that says, what is the percentage of your salary that you want to put in your 401k, and your company will match it. Now, the person who makes this decision is actually going to bring less money home for the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. If you think about it from their perspective, they say, do I bring more money home and maybe get somebody smiles at me slightly better? Or do I do this thing that maybe somebody will say thank you 30 years from now, right? And it's a very tough trade-off. And when you think about it like this, you say, you know, what are we asking people to do? We're really asking them to do a hidden sacrifice. So imagine that instead you go to people and you say, before you fill your 401k, call your significant other and say, hi, darling, I'm this new place. They give us, not me, us an opportunity to save for our retirement. We can choose this percent or this percent. What do you think? And then write down what the significance other thing, what you think, and make a decision. What happens when this is the process? What happens is that the person all of a sudden gets brownie point at the point of the decision, right? And we've shown that when people do these things, they think more long-term, they think together and so on, they're willing to sacrifice more. Now, 2 years later, will the significant other remember that the person working is putting more money in a 401k? Of course not. But from a design perspective, you want them to feel that they're getting their credit, the social credit at the moment of the decision. You want to give them the benefit of going up, and then it's just on autopilot. So it's really taking the perspective of the person, realizing the pressures that they're under, trying to figure out where we can add some motivation that would get people to make the right long-term decision.
All right. Super fascinating. And what I love about you is, I have a financial advisor who I interview every week on this program, a guy named Lance Roberts, and it's rare where I don't make a statement and he says, oh, you know, I just wrote an article about that, right? You're that way where we'll talk about something and you'll say, oh, well, there's a study I know about that, right? And in we did a study for my old company once where you surveyed our users and you used that data in one of your research projects. We talked a little bit about that, the potential for doing that leading up to this interview. We didn't have time, but if you have interest in tapping the collective brain power and just human nature of the Wealthion viewership, I'll speak for the collective here and say we'd love to make ourselves available to you for that. Folks, if you're watching and that interests you, let us know in the comment section below. But I do just want to offer, Dan, if this audience can play a role in help advancing behavioral economics' understanding of some of these, you know, incentives and tips and tricks that we can use to help people make better informed decisions about their money, we'd love to help move that ball down the field for science.
Very good. I will come back to you with that.
Okay, great. All right, well, look, I'm trying to be real surgical here because we don't have a ton of time left. Let me show you where I'm going and then let me ask a question before then. The main question I sort of want to end on is beyond what we've talked about already, are there decisions or reforms or changes you'd like to see both on an individual, corporate, or national level that you think can kind of help improve our situation going forward from here, given from where we are right now with all the challenges we face and the imperfections of our current status quo? But before we get there, I want to ask you a specific question just to get your thoughts on it if you have them, which is, I don't know if you put out a macroeconomic outlook or not, but right now we have a really big divergence between what the stock market is, how it's performing this year so far, versus the underlying economic data. If you look at the underlying macroeconomic data, the vast preponderance are saying, you know, Houston, there's a problem, right? A lot of them are at recessionary levels. There's a lot of potential shoes to drop just from the lag effect of all the rate hikes that the central banks have made in the past year and a half.
Yeah.
The market does not seem to care at all.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have thoughts about that from a behavioral economic standpoint. You know, what allows the critical mass of market participants that drive pricing to say, you know what, we don't really care that much about the data?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, I think the assumption that the markets are long-term thinking, I just don't see a lot of evidence for that. You know, the rationality of the market is a very interesting assumption, but it means that people think long term. I just don't think that's that, and I think that this divergence it's not a proof, but it's another piece of evidence in support of that. And the other thing is that we have created a stock market that has a very large influx of money on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
From retirement funds, and that's going to have a distortion effect, right? Because there's just something you can count on that keeps on pumping in. That doesn't happen to the regular market. There's much more flexibility and change, and you know whether people are feeling comfortable or not. It's not as if when people feel less comfortable, all of a sudden they change their deductions for 401k. And you have a lower influx. That's the benefit of automated decision, but it's that also means that it's less informative about that. But maybe two thoughts before we end. And you asked me about what do I think about improving. So, you know, research is like kids. You like your kids more than you like other people's kids. So I like my research more than I like other people's, but in the last 6 years, I have been doing research on how companies treat their employees, how the employees feel about the company, and what it means for the stock market return of those companies. And I started with data about almost all Fortune 500 going back to 2006. And in general, we think about extrinsic motivation and intrinsic motivation. extrinsic motivation is a salary and quality of the chairs and bonuses and health benefits and financial benefit, health benefits, retirement benefits. And in general, we don't find that those have a lot of alpha signal. On the other hand, you have intrinsic motivation, things like, do people feel appreciated, psychological safety? Do you feel aligned with the goals of the company? Do they feel that promotion is fair? Do they feel the salary is fair? And those things have a big impact. And by the way, we give this we rank all the companies now on how good they are in terms of their human capital. And we give it to a company called Harbor Capital, and they have a couple of ETFs out in the market that are using that as a filter. Let's take the Fortune 500, but let's just take the top 50% who are treating their employees well. But I think that human capital is probably one of the most important things for companies. You know, the CEO of Harbor Capital is saying it's an accounting mistake. You know, how come it's not on the balance sheet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a company buys a warehouse, it's an investment. They invest in people, it's a cost. You know, something about that perspective is wrong. So if you ask me there's lots of things that can be fixed, but one of the things that I think is important is this engine of growth in each company. It's the quality of the people and how well you treat them. And I think it's incredibly important to start quantifying and thinking about that. So sometimes
making it visible.
Exactly. So I'm kind of dreaming about one day that in quarterly report and annual report, people report on human capital. And they and also that companies put real effort into this. Most companies, treating people well is not very high on their priority. It's a chicken and egg, right? Because if they reported on it and investors care about it, they would care about it more and so on. So I think it's one of those things where the stock market not only benefit from it, but also influence it. Everybody
wins in that one. Yeah. And I'm curious, did your research show that the companies that treat people better, do they tend to outperform in the long run?
Yeah. Yeah. So we've shown that it has a good signal in alpha. And JP Morgan did a couple of, actually three, they issued three papers on our data. Showing not only that it has their quant group, not only that it has alpha, but it's not correlated with other things, right? So it's not momentum or something else. It's a separate factor that should be considered. So I think that's a kind of, you know, because I'm so into this research, and because I just think, you know, here is something that because we don't count, we don't care as much. But if we counted, people would care about, and everybody would be better off. The employees would be better off. The shareholders would be better off. Management would be better off. Following the principle, you are what you measure. Let's start measuring it, and let's start getting better. So that's one. And then maybe the final thought is that I told you that since the beginning of COVID, I have had my experience with people who do not believe in all kinds of things related to COVID, a range of things, and some things are more understandable and not, and some not. But as a consequence of that, I spent the last almost 3 years in a lot of dens of misinformation. And it's a terrifying world. You know, if 10 years you ask me what are the real challenges facing the modern world, this information wouldn't have been up there. It is now. And this book I just finished called Misbelief, it's really a psychological view of what happens to people and how they go down the funnel of misbelief, how people start not believing whatever, right? But basically, eventually some people become conspiracy theorists, but every step down the funnel of misbelief is an expensive step for society and for the individuals. So I think that's another thing that we, you know, in the same way that the cookie attacks human nature in the wrong way, so it's true for misinformation. It's attacking our psyche in a way that is bad for us for the short term and for the long term. And we need to think about how we deal with this. And by the way, in the stock market too, right? There's lots of misinformation out there as well. So anyway, yeah. So that's the next adventure.
Yeah, this is tough. So this whole quality of information topic, super interesting. I'm trying to wrap this interview up because I know you have a hard stop here, Dan. So I'm going to have to force myself to stop there. But I really look forward to digging into this with you in detail when your book comes out later this year, and we can have you back on the program. We can do a whole interview just dedicated to that topic. And that's going to be roughly when, September-ish timeframe?
The book is out September 19th.
Okay, great. Fantastic. So we'll be reaching back out to you around then to do the big unveil for us. Before that time, for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation and would like to learn more about you and follow your work, where should they go?
Just my website, danarielly.com, danarielly.com.
All right, perfect. When we edit this, Dan, I will put the URL up here on the screen so folks know exactly where to go. I'll put a link in the description as well. All right, Dan, it's been a total pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on the channel. When you were talking about financial advisors earlier, that's a big part of what we do on this channel is we try to combat information asymmetry by bringing on experts like you. And then we try to help people make it actionable by working with financial professionals who understand all the issues we talk about here and to try to take, you know, the emotion out of it, to put in programmatic solutions for them. So, you know, we're removing the friction and we're hopefully removing a lot of the evolutionary things that could trip us up along the way. But one thing you mentioned, and I'll just part on this, is I think Wealthion is actually doing something kind of right in terms of your philosophy, which is I bring on these financial advisors every week and we do a market recap. We talk about, you know, what the market's done, but we talk about decisions that they are making in real time based upon what's happening to their client portfolios. So we're showing people the work that the financial advisor does on a week by week basis. And so we're actually making a lot of that invisible work visible. Because like you said, most people, they look at their statements maybe once a month. A lot of people don't even open them, you know, that frequently. And then maybe they have a year-end review with the person, right? And they just look at the number and they're kind of like, well, what did you do for that, right? We're showing them what goes on there and hopefully showing them what to look for in a good financial advisor. So on wrapping up with that, folks, if you want to talk to one of Wealthion's financial advisors for free, you can do that by just going to wealthion.com. Those consultations totally free. There's no commitment to work with them. It's just a free public service. If you've enjoyed having Dan on this program and look forward to having him back on when his book comes out, please vote your support for that by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on the channel here.
I'm here. Looking forward to next time.
All right. And just to let you go, Dan, real quick, I want to remind people, I think the last time I saw you, we were on a dance floor in South Carolina
with
Maggie Grace from Lost, so the actress from Lost, with Scott Kelly, the astronaut. And I think your son, who was like 10 years old around the time, who I remember had just insane dance moves. So anyways, it's so great to see you and how your career has progressed 10 years later.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Take care.
Bye. Everyone else, thanks so much for watching.